zieht und zieht mich hinaus auf See. Mein Kind, sei nicht traurig, tut auch der Abschied weh. Mein Herz, geht an Bord und fort muss die Reise gehen. Dein Schmerz wird vergehen und schön wird das Wiedersehen.
Willkommen to Snakes and Funerals. Today we are going to be talking about the films of German director Helmut Kautner. And I have today Eli, who's here with me always. Guten Tag, Eli.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest joining us today, continuing our They Shot Pictures reunion tour. I'm very happy to welcome John to the show. John, thanks for joining us.
Hello. I don't know German to say something witty right now, but...
Guten Tag, John.
Guten Tag. Okay. Believe me, there was no wit involved in that. There was just a brief
basic
thing to Google
German
Translate.
Knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
no way. Thank you for having me.
Yes, we're happy to have you. And as anyone who has listened to some of our earlier episodes knows, They Shot Pictures was a podcast that was one of the primary things that got me to want to do this. And we've had Sean and
Same.
Seema on the show. So very happy to complete the trifecta here and nab John for an episode. So
I don't know if it would count as a trifecta. I was barely on that.
Oh, you were on that. Well, you also had another show with Seema, right?
Oh, yeah. I think Cinema on the Road. I think some episodes are still out there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope to one day like get them all back. But yeah, I was on a few episodes of They Shot Pictures. And hopefully it will continue at some point. I don't know what Seema's up to.
Yeah, I don't know. It's dormant, but not defunct, hopefully. So we typically make a point on this show, I would say, to pick topics that bear no relation whatsoever to what's going on in film world writ large. So we picked today's topic, as I've mentioned, German director Helmut Kautner, a couple months ago, and quite sure of our smug obscurity, but who knew? Kautner is very hot right now. He had a little mini retrospective that played at Il Cinema Ritrovato, and I don't know. I mean, that's more topicality than we usually go for. So
let's say that they stole it from us then.
Yeah, we had the. I mean, I was surprised to see that we had the idea months ago, but
yeah.
No one's asking
me. I'm actually a programmer there,
Well, I'm
so
glad
is,
we have an
this
expert.
Will be posted. This will be posted on their website as a accompanying a retrospective. So
wow, I'm glad to be affiliated with such an august institution as Cinema Retrovato.
I've never
gone anyway.
but anyway, so even if Kautner is having the smallest of moments right now, I think he's still a relatively unknown figure in the Anglophone world, despite having a few films that are somewhat official classics, I guess. And I guess it's worth mentioning at the outset before we dive in, which I'm sure this will come up as we talk more specifically about the films, but that Kautner worked and started his career in Nazi Germany, though he was avowedly himself not a Nazi. And I think that the work that he produced during that period provides pretty ample evidence that Kautner's politics was not in any way towing the party line. I guess that's just worth mentioning. And I think his movies have this sort of rhapsodic, delirious quality and a belief in people that comes through in those Nazi era films. I guess also worth mentioning that he started his career in political cabaret in the 30s. All of which is just to say that I think the film that we're going to discuss today that was made in Nazi Germany. I guess just to put that in some context. Yeah, and I just think that sort of delirium of style and thought is what seems really central to Kautner. I'm sure we'll get into some of that. And that sort of manic style that he has comes in fits and spurts. And some of the films, it's a little overwhelming for me. We're not talking about his film Montpy, but it's just this totally nutty Paris romance that those tendencies are just at their most sort of baroque expression. And then he also made these sort of series of more dramatic films in the 50s, which I didn't see too many myself, but they seem comparatively kind of dry and preachy to these other films. So that's kind of just an interesting different aspect of Kautner. And I think those are the films that won him the most praise at the time. I think he won a prize at Cannes for The Last Bridge, which is an extremely dry war film. But anyways, the films we're talking about today sort of, I think, exemplify the more ecstatic tendencies of his films. And so we're going to be talking about Great Freedom, number 7, The Apple Fell, which is also goes by the title The Original Sin, and his film Ludwig. So before we dive into the films, I thought I'd just open the floor to you guys if you have any introductory words.
Yeah, I think that if any of his films is a known factor, it would be one that we're not talking about today, Under the Bridges, Unter den Brücken, which is a very, very good film. It is bound to remind people of L'Atlante, but it does do its own thing. Again, not going to really talk about it today, but the reason we're not talking about it is because it is, I think, rather a known quality, not because we don't like it. At least, that's how it is for me. Let's just get into it.
Okay, let's do it. John, any opening thoughts on Kautner? Should we jump in?
Well, for me, like, he wasn't like really a known quantity. I was aware of him. Like, he had a reputation for these kind of 40s melodramas made, you know, under the Nazi regime. That's kind of all I knew about him. So looking into his filmography, like, after the 40s, really, like, after that three-year period where he was making Under the Bridges, Great Freedom, and I guess Romance in a Minor Key, which are the films I kind of knew about him. Those are the ones I knew. Actually, looking past those years and seeing, like, the variety of stuff he was working on, and, like, it made me really excited to actually dig into his filmography. I wasn't able to watch as much as I wanted to. I wasn't able to watch, like, 6 films of his for this podcast. But I was looking at the filmography and I was thinking, you know, there's at least a dozen here that I would love to see, because they all look so interesting and strange. And even up to the 60s, like some of his last final works, I know, I think Eli saw one called, I think Redhead, even that looks pretty good.
Was that his last film?
I don't think it was his last movie, but certainly among his last theatrical releases.
Mm-hmm.
I think he went on to work in TV at some point. He even has like a Hamlet adaptation in there somewhere. I don't know, looking even just with these 6 films, I think I'm just getting started in Kautner explorations.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really eager to talk to you guys about this.
Yeah, he does have it seems like a very wide swath of like interests that crop up throughout his career. So yeah, it does seem like there's a lot to explore. So okay, well, let's dive into the first film today, which is Great Freedom, number 7. I think after Under the Bridges, which Eli mentioned, this is probably Kautner's most well-known film, and I think for very good reason. At least for myself, this is the one of all the films that I watched, and I think I saw, I don't know, about 10 or something like that, that was easily my favorite among those. It takes place in Hamburg, Germany, in a sort of no time space. Like it was shot during the end of the war, and I guess they were like moving constantly as they were shooting it across Europe to sort of flee the Allied bombing. And so the movie was sort of completed on the run. But there's no real sense of the war in the film, although maybe a little bit around the edges and some small touches that Kavner infuses the film with. But really it focuses on this bar district in Hamburg and this cabaret sort of bar that a sailor who is now landlocked works at as a singing seaman. And it sort of follows his relationship with the young girlfriend of his brother who has just died. And he takes her under his wing and falls in love with her. But really the narrative of this film is sort of somewhat inconsequential and subsumed to the style of the thing, which is shot in just glorious Agfa color and just filled with this incredibly ornate set design of this bar that the movie takes place in. And the whole thing just sort of feels suffused with this like nautical sea air and shots through ships in glass jars and things like that. So it was really the sort of visual texture of this film that stuck with me the most.
Yeah, so I agree. This is a beautiful, beautiful film. And Agfa Color produces a really unique color palette, I think, that everything has this like almost amber glow to it. And you're right that this movie does seem to be out of place. And that's how I would really describe all his films that I've seen, unless they are specifically set in a period piece, like we'll talk about later with Ludwig. Not to spend too much time comparing Kautner to other later filmmakers, but I almost have a hard time believing that Fassbinder did not see this film, because this is as much proto-Fassbinder as Cirque, frankly, with its feelings of these love conflicts that end up with everyone feeling bitter and nothing and nobody is satisfied at the end of the movie. This movie begins after the credits with this beautiful ship shot from the exterior. It has this sky that is, I don't remember if it's at sunrise or sunset, but it's beautiful. But right after that, Kautner cuts to a ship in the bottle, which looks exactly the same as the ship we just saw. And that's this movie in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
You have these weird, almost mechanical or stereotypical reproductions of the real thing. And it can almost come across as a societal critique, but I think it might go even deeper than that. Because this movie doesn't seem like it's tied to a specific time period, I think it's saying that the idea of this romantic figure of the German singing sailor is fake and gaudy, but the film isn't fake and gaudy. It's quite beautiful, as we said. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Regarding the, I guess, the Fassbinder qualities here, what struck me most, first of all, I didn't know this movie was in color at all. so when I started watching it, I was blown away by the colors of the film. And then after I got that over that initial reaction, I started to realize, like, especially those moments in the, I guess, the place where he sings "Actual Great Freedom," the place where he sings, the color is downright garish, I would say. not only that of not only that of the film, but also like the makeup of like the main actor. It reminded me a lot of the Fosse film Cabaret, where some of like the I guess the makeup and the color are kind of a little bit grotesque at some points. Like I don't know if anyone was if anyone had that reaction as
Yeah,
well.
the makeup, especially in the close-up shots, like it's just so thick on, especially I can't remember his name, the lead character.
Yeah,
Yeah, for
Hans.
sure.
Who,
Hans,
by the
yeah.
way, was
Hans.
originally supposed to be called Johnny, but Goebbels made Kautner change it because he wanted it to be more German, which actually ended up making the movie more of a critique of Germany by having this very German name. Yeah, I totally agree that it is gaudy, but I don't think it is. It's not gaudy for the sake of being gaudy, but it's not so distant that you can't enjoy it on an immediate, sensory level. It is so wild. It's almost like a circus scene. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, those scenes inside like the Great Freedom where they're riding, they bring out like I guess the donkeys or whatever
Yeah.
to ride them around.
It's like a
It's
bar game.
yeah, it's pretty bizarre.
Well, who,
And it looks
I
like a
forget
circus. I mean,
that.
it's shaped like a circus, right? I mean, it's like a in the round kind of
Yes.
cabaret setup. Yeah, and this dirt floor in the middle where they're parading around on farm animals.
I love how Kautner will shoot a close-up that really the only the eyes are illuminated.
Yeah, he does that a few times where I think it's the first time is when Hans is dreaming about going back to the sea. And I think he's looking at a ship in a bottle
Yeah,
and
I know
his
what you're
eyes
talking about.
like light up blue. And he's, I can't remember if there's anything like a voiceover or anything, but it's very clearly he's like sort of dreaming about going back to the sea and his eyes sort of have this blue color. Yeah, it's a very strange effect, but quite striking.
And the woman, I forget the character's name, who works at the cabaret bar, has as we were talking about with the gaudiness, this really obvious caked on makeup, and it really gives you the impression that this is a defeated place that you only come to when you can't go anywhere else.
Yeah, and that's kind of that's a little bit addressed with the fact that Hans keeps insisting that he's a sailor, that he'll go back into the sea, when literally everything about his life suggests that he's just gonna stay here forever.
He's playing a sailor who's playing a sailor. You know, the idea of a singing sailor is, I think, a bit of, at least it was, a trope, and it's something that tourists would want to see in this port town, and
Well, the movie kind of literalizes that when you first see the Great Freedom, the shot that sort of slinks through the streets and then comes up to the bar. There's a like mechanical reproduction of Hans outside the bar, sort of like a little music box version of Hans, which I think is it's kind of all right there in that image.
I it's so early on in the movie, but I always go back to when he visits his dying brother in the hospital. The lighting on his brother, even before he dies in the scene, makes him look like a dead man. He's coated with sweat, and there is again the illumination in the brother's eyes, but it's a different type compared to what he was. I mean, not l it's not literally a different type, it's just contextually, his facial expression is completely different, but it's so interesting that it's the same effect, and you don't really understand exactly what his relationship is with his brother, which is to say, there's some nuances that I feel like we never get in the movie, and that's not a complaint. I like the mystery of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we've not really touched on the what I think is the strangeness of the narrative of this movie, especially in the early stretches, and that's something that I actually think recurs throughout these Kautner films. Like the sort of dramatic arc of these films moves in very odd kinds of fits and spurts, and there are these weird sort of ellipses, like you're saying, where things just don't really get explained all that much. And by the end of the film, it's sort of easy to forget what the initial catalyst for his relationship with this woman is, that it was his brother's death, or at least it was for me, because the movie moves so quickly past that sequence and sort of into something else.
One of my favorite parts of the movie is, I guess, toward the end, he is looking at the ship in the bottle in bed, and then he sort of dozes off, and we get this long, extended dream sequence, which is, again, to bring up Fassbinder, almost like proto end of Berlin and Alexander Platz and how weird it is.
Yeah, the dream sequence is great, and sort of, I think, looks ahead to some of the other sequences in the later counter films that get really extreme like that.
Yeah, and we've said, I think, correctly that it looks ahead. I think it also looks to the past of film history, because there's so much of this film that is shot in these great canted angles, which reminds us of expressionism.
Connor does seem to be kind of in love with the dream sequences. There's one, there's a really strange kind of weird one also later on in his career in Montpellier, I believe it is. And they do show up here, like, is there another one in, what's the name? I can't remember the name of it. If you feel like there's quite a few in these films, these extended like dream sequences or visions that he just loves to take his time with, and even more so. And for example, with the film we're going to talk about, The Apple Fell, which is basically an extended it's one giant dream sequence.
Yeah, I mean that movie does feel like it was constructed with that explicit purpose to just give him full.
Well, let's get to
but
that.
Yeah, so we'll get to that shortly. but I guess just to return to the sort of proprietress of the bar, who John, you had mentioned, and her sort of caked on makeup. I mean, I think she is where I see the most sort of Fassbinder connection in the film. Like, she does feel like a character that could have just walked in from a Fassbinder set, sort of, as you were suggesting, a sort of dilapidated, like disused, woman, middle-aged woman, who clearly loves Hans, and Hans doesn't really return her affection. And I think that's actually where I find the sort of emotional root of the film is in their relationship. Like as I had said sort of at the beginning, Hans develops this sort of relationship with his dead brother's girlfriend, and sort of falls in love with her, and she's significantly younger than he is, and she falls in love with a younger man closer to her own age, and much of the movie is sort of spent watching Hans try to negotiate his love for this woman. But I think that the relationship between Hans and the woman who owns the Great Freedom is really sort of the emotional crux of the movie for me, because I think she sort of represents most the kind of life that he actually leads versus the sort of sea life that he dreams for himself, or even this more sort of domestic alternative that he imagines for himself with the younger woman. I think there's something about Hans sort of rejecting her that is Hans kind of lying to himself about what his life actually is, and that sort of devastates her. There's that great shot towards the end, which is very Fassbender, of when Hans leaves the bar for the last time, and she's in there sort of bereft and alone, and the camera pulls back like very quickly through the whole bar space, and she's left alone sort of way deep in the frame suddenly. I love that shot.
So do I.
So many of this of Kautner's movies, I mean, I find it hard to like deal with them. I feel like they're more, I experience them more in like moment to moment shots and like camera angles and like the camera movement versus, and basically all the emotions that those bring in versus like a big thematic reading of his filmography so far, at least. And I kind of get lost more in that almost pure sensation of like, wow, this guy is really having fun doing all this camera stuff. But also in this particular film, I feel he imbues that kind of technical, almost showmanship as much as you can have with the way this movie was made, with like true deep melancholy for the character and situation with the woman who owns the bar. That character, I sense that like kind of what you're saying, that's the one person who kind of sees him as he truly is, who kind of sees the truth of his life. And as you're saying, a lot of what he does is trying to reject that version of himself, as you're saying, like he's lying, like he's lying to himself. It's, and that rejection, that in the final moments when he decides what he wants to do, it's pretty moving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the movie ends with him going back to sea, and the sort of shot of the, I think it's like of the bow of the ship, and he's on the ship back at sea. But there's something about that feels, it's both freeing and he's sort of escaped, but it's also a kind of trap for him simultaneously. And he sort of retreated to something that he knows and sort of takes easy comfort in, instead of having to deal with the emotional scars that he left behind.
Yeah. He brings his accordion with him, at least. He's, seen carrying his accordion out, and it's implied, I think, that he takes it with him, that he's not really giving up his role as the seeing sailor before he goes to actually be a sailor again, because he hasn't learned anything or changed for the better in any way, and he's deluded himself. The only thing that's changed is that he has broken the heart of the only person who ever actually loved him.
Yeah, sad. The other moment that I think is sort of the most moving moment in this film, and again, I had a somewhat similar experience to John, in that I was so dazzled and sort of numbed by Kautner's visual techniques that sometimes like what he's doing emotionally or dramatically didn't register as much, which I think is maybe a problem for me in some of the other films that we're not talking about. But this one does have like that moment we talked about at the end, and a few scenes that do sort of find a way to, as you said, John, highlight that melancholy through the style. The other sequence I was thinking of is when he prepares this like elaborate meal in his apartment for the young woman, and he's expecting to propose to her. And he just lays out this like elaborate table with this like lace cloth on it and all this food and drink. And he just sort of sits there alone and just keeps drinking as she is out with her younger boyfriend as he sort of expects her to come home, and that scene of him sort of in this like domestic space that he wants to have for himself, but ultimately he just ends up sort of another like drunken sailor in that space, is another sequence that I find rather moving in this film.
So I didn't see the first six Great Freedoms, so I feel like I don't have that much more to say.
I did, well, the title, actually, I did read that originally Kautner just wanted to call it Great Freedom, and it was Goebbels or someone else in the Nazi regime that required that they add number 7 to the end to indicate that it was a place rather than...
a concept.
Yeah, a concept, yeah. Or an idea. So
strange.
Well, Nazis for you. But,
you know, the more I hear about these Nazis, the more I'm just not a fan.
Yeah, a reasonable assumption, I think. But yeah, I do think there is something. I mean, we said at the beginning that the movie doesn't really touch on the war at all. And that's certainly true in the plot. But there is something in the ferocity of its sort of aesthetic revolt that even though it's not saying anything explicitly critical, it just does seem so against the prescribed aesthetics of Nazi Germany that you can't help, I think, at least for me, read it as something of a rebellion against that, if in style more than in word.
Completely, and it is a remarkable movie.
Okay, shall we take a break and then come back and discuss The Apple Fell?
Yep.
Wo fahren wir jetzt hin? Adam, wo fahren wir hin?
Zur Hölle, gnädigste. Zur Hölle.
Ich hoffe, es wird Ihnen bei uns gefallen. Sie sind unsere ersten Gäste. Wollen Sie nicht ablegen? Es ist gut gehandelt. Immer noch böse? Wollen Sie bitte mitlaufen?
All right. Back from our break, and the next film we're talking about is Der Apfel ist ab, or The Apple Fell, or The Original Sin, depending on how you want to do it. It's from 1948. So, yes, as we were saying, Kautner had an extensive post-war period for decades, and as to him not being a Nazi, this film... I think bolsters that, but we can get into that later. I'm not sure about you guys, but when I was watching this movie at first, I thought, oh, you know, this is an allegory, but it's just one of those, you know, hey, this is an allegory, but we're not going to explicitly say that it's an allegory until about 20 minutes into the movie. But no, this is a delirious fantasy that ridicules our ideas of, or at least traditional ideas of sin and temptation. By starting with a more realistic framework, which I think it needed to do to make the other stuff effective, and in the first 20 minutes are, by the way, a lot of fun and very good. That suicide attempt is really funny, but you do get the sense at first that it is a film about devastation of Germany after World War II. And yeah, there are ruins and there are posters of propaganda to get back up and you know, keep on going. But as you find out that this is a purely domestic issue, and it is also a mocking of the idea of psychology by having the director himself, Helmut Kautner, Mandel, this legend, dress up as the good doctor who looks really like, you know, Freud, sort of.
He's got Freud's beard.
But yeah. I think that might be enough of a general intro. Do you want to get to it? Oh, and the main character looks like Igor Stravinsky, and I love it.
He does kind of look like Stravinsky. Yeah, I mean, I think what struck me most about this film, at least initially, was, as you were saying, that it starts in this more realistic place. It's sort of this Trummer film, you know, that takes place in the rubble. And there were a few films that Kautner made before this, like immediately after the war, that I think more explicitly fit that genre, you know, more along the lines of like Germany Year Zero or something like that, sort of like realistic post-war dramas about rebuilding. And this film sort of starts that way, but is very clearly in some ways poking fun at the idea of that kind of serious, realistic film. And as we had said, talking about Great Freedom, this is the film where Kautner just explodes the structure to be one extended sort of fantasy sequence, and that the movie starts in this place of post-war Germany. To get there is, I think,
so even before the dream sequence, you know, there's the, you know, fake paradise outside the window, which is the most obviously fake mountain range with clouds over it ever.
Are you talking about in the doctor's office where he...
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he has these windows that he, like, or these little, like, scrims that he can, like, bring up in front of the window to block out the rubble. And it's, yeah, like a, you know, beach scene or a mountain or, you know...
And when he goes to it's Satan's Club or something like that, and it has a picture of a snake on it, and then there are giant devil statues inside the club. And this is before it gets into the actual dream sequence, and it's already weird as hell.
Those early moments are just full of this, like, exaggerated, like, angles, and giving off this almost, you know, it's trying to invest you in that like moment of like great drama of this person's life. Like, he's making this choice. We're not entirely sure what it's gonna be, but it's incredibly exaggerated in like the effects that he's going to. And you find this a lot in I saw it a lot in Great Freedom. But also in the original, excuse me, I'm looking at the thing. It says the original. So we're going with the apple, when the apple fell.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call it.
Right. I find this a lot during the films I've seen of Kautner, this reliance on these, on the filmic effects, right? To get his points across. You know, superimpositions, little like camera movement. He's everything for me derives from his filmic choice, from his filmic choices.
I really love right before the dream sequence. Our main character is in front of, or rather, we see him, you know, in close up from the front, and behind him there's this circle. I'm not sure if it's a mirror, but there's light that shines on it, which completely then envelops him before Kautner goes to an extreme close-up of him and pulls out to reveal the start of the dream sequence. And it's so fun. And I love how even like the clouds are hung with obvious wires. The light is fake. The light has like a physical prop. It's like painted on light, that you know, the kind of light that like shines through the clouds, mm-hmm. that sort of light. It's like wood.
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie has that the sense of chintzy is like not exactly the right word because that has a sort of negative connotation, but handmade maybe. Like, there's something about the set design and everything in this film that, like, yeah, he's clearly not going for anything that's going to stand in for a kind of realistic representation of the objects. The favorite of mine in that regard is in the sort of heaven sequences. I guess it's worth saying, I don't know that we mentioned this yet, that the film, when it goes into the fantasy sequence, is sort of this delirious recreation of the Adam and Eve myth.
Which it doesn't leave until like the last minute of the movie.
What's that?
Which it doesn't leave that into the last
yeah,
minute of the movie.
Right, exactly. You know? Yeah, it stays in that space. So, yeah. But there's a sequence when they're in the Garden of Eden with all these animals. And it's like the most ridiculous version of like an elephant or a lion. I can't remember these like little paper mache like doll things yeah. that look like when like monks, you know, used to draw like foreign animals that they'd never seen before, like bizarre looking elephants based on like hearsay. Like, it does not look like anyone who's ever seen an elephant compose this little creature or this little lion or whatever. But I love those little touches.
And he's dressed in, like, toddler clothes that are sized for an adult man. And then he acts like a child for the whole movie. And so does Eve, by the way. All the wings are like, little... wire wings. I would be remiss if we didn't mention the real star of this movie, Satan himself, who is just a delight. I forget the actor's name, but the way he plays Satan, who was, I believe another doctor with like a different opinion or a private investigator. I can't remember. I should know that. But in this fantasy, he whisks our protagonist away to hell in this one sequence. And there's this trolley that goes to hell. And the neon sign in German reads, "Come spend an evening in hell." And of course, there are Nazis in hell.
As there should
entire
be.
Sequence, the entire sequence is so crazy. When they're, it's like then hell is basically a nightclub, and he's the host, I guess.
And there already and was a Satan nightclub in the movie that's supposed to be the real Satan nightclub.
Yeah. But then it like they actually literalize it this in the dream sequence. But once they're actually in the. In, I guess, the club or whatever, they're showing all these atrocities as, like, entertainment. He's like, hey, you can witness torture here. You can look at what the youth is doing, and it's just, like, dancing.
The horrors.
I like how Kautner, as the good angel director, keeps messing up because he wears rose-tinted glasses.
Yeah, he has a literally rosy view of these people. That's funny. Yeah, I do think that sequence in Satan's Club is the best thing in the movie. And I actually was thinking as I was watching it that I feel like Kautner, at least for me, I think I get the sense you guys may like this movie a little bit more than I do, but has a somewhat Milton-esque problem of not being able to make heaven and the Garden of Eden quite as interesting as Satan and hell.
No, I don't think it's the same thing because he is okay with ridiculing the idea of heaven as much as
well,
he
that's
is okay
true.
With yeah. So it is, I think, compelling for me because it is such an obvious parody of the idea of a perfect paradise, but it is run by a committee of people who frankly keep messing up. There's this scene where he offers these people, sorry to interrupt, but that he offers, the builders, a cigarette to work on the dog, even though they say that they're on union break.
Heaven is just like these series of offices and people in white lab coats trying to figure things out. Paradise is just like this patch of artificial earth that's guarded over by a security guard, and it just seems like a zoo display. I think it looks like a zoo display, or like a museum display where you would walk by and you see Adam and Eve in what paradise is supposed to look like.
Yeah, isn't there a moment where like some like old ladies like walk by and look at them like they're in a zoo?
Yes. And he also keeps trying to fly.
Also, Earth itself is just they keep building Earth as I guess a model, or I don't know if it's paper mache or something like that.
Yeah. But
they all keep hovering over Earth, trying to actually make Earth in their one of the little labs.
Yeah, and I like the movie's use of Heaven to sort of further its spoofing of like psychiatry and especially the sort of like medicalized version of psychiatry. Like you were saying, Eli, that God Kautner in this scenario like constantly fails because he just doesn't actually understand the impulses that are driving the sort of Adam and Eve character, and he sort of views them as maybe more innocent than they actually are.
Well, no, it's that they are. I have to disagree that they are innocent to a fault is the problem, and they have no idea what they're doing, and that is the point of, I feel like, the temptation and then the switcheroo that happens, which is again a problem that is not fixed by Kautner playing the angel wearing the glasses that Lilith goes to Earth.
Although I guess there's a way in which the whole fantasy sequence, because it takes place in the dream of the main character, who the whole reason that he's going to the psychiatrist in the first place is because he has an inability to choose between having a life with his wife and running off with his mistress, and he wants both. And Kautner's psychiatrist is sort of trying to instruct him that he can't realistically, maintain a relationship with both his wife and his mistress. But the whole fantasy sequence is sort of like a long self-justification for him getting what he wants in the end.
Yeah, I don't think that the film, is like, let's definitely give him what he wants because he deserves it, but his own dream sequence is to justify it.
Correct.
And I think that's where the humor comes in, that it is so ridiculous that it just ends up resolving as, we're going to combine these two women into one.
Yeah, but I guess that's where I see maybe the failings of Kautner's psychiatrist. I get what you're saying, like they behave like children, like innocents, but really the sort of subconscious force that's compelling this whole fantasy sequence is to get to a place where the main character gets to have, as you said, a woman that is literally composed of his wife and his mistress. And so the sort of motivations for the fantasy itself are maybe less than benign.
And, the meeting at the end, as we were talking about when they're combined into one person, almost seems like a conference between nations. Like, this is a treaty that they're settling. And it almost seems like it's reenacting the treaty that just happened and is maybe expressing some unease over, okay, well, we tried a treaty once after a war and that didn't go well. Are we sure that this is going to go well again?
And so it's just that little, you know, this isn't, I think, a very political movie, but I think that and the stuff at the beginning and then having the Nazis in hell, theoretically a time before there were Nazis, are all, you know, sly political humor that I have to give Kepner a lot of credit for.
Even the original agreement where Kautner is ready to agree to it, but they'll actually, Temptation and Eve will both be with him, with Adam. they tell him, you're wearing your rosy glasses again.
Yes. Everything is a problem.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was trying to get to about the psychiatrist. Yeah. You know, like, he doesn't see through that, but.
Oh, and what you brought up, the fantastic bug-eyed looking lion thing. I like how after he eats the apple and there's a giant fake worm inside, he sees the lion ate the lamb.
I don't know that I got that, actually. Maybe I did, but
yeah, because they were shown together,
yeah,
earlier.
That's funny.
Yeah,
well, and the sort of the political images that you were sort of referencing in the movie, Eli, like, I did think it was interesting too that in the sequence where Satan gets rejected from the like angels, it's like him in this like military formation, like all the angels are lined up in these like sort of uniforms of whatever the angels wear, and he's sort of ejected from the military of angels, and that even heaven itself is sort of suffused with this kind of militarism is interesting. The movie itself is sort of like anti-Manichaean, and the way that Kautner, as we suggest, like spoofs heaven and sort of allows some of these maybe darker images of like militarism to be a part of the heavenly sequences, I think gets to his unwillingness to take any kind of side.
I think Lubitsch would have really liked this movie.
Yes. Well, I was sort of expecting it to actually resolve in a sort of design for living kind of way, where they just sort of like decide to have a threesome and shrug their shoulders and life goes on. But this comes up with a rather more bizarre solution to his problem.
Yeah, it is bizarre. I don't think it is a capitulation to him, or, you know, because you're still really uneasy at the very end when he, you know, seems to say, I want to have both, therefore I can have both. You know, that doesn't, nothing's resolved.
Yeah, I don't think anything about the movie says, you know, now that he's going to have this one person, that means all your problems are going to be solved, or anything about your personality, or the personality of the character, leads us to believe that this is like the ultimate solution. I was about to say final solution.
Ooh, yeah.
Not a good.
When Nazis are involved.
No, yeah, exactly. This solution for him is not really a solution at all. It's not really going to solve anything for him. He's still him.
Well, and then when the movie actually ends, it reemerges from the fantasy sequence, and the main character, leaves the psychiatrist's like modernist office because he failed the basic test that the psychiatrist imposed on him of not eating this apple. We should just say that the regimen, like the psychological regimen that the psychiatrist has for helping people get over their problems, is like the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen regarding psychiatry in a movie. Like, his whole regimen is that you just, like, he has a shelf full of apples and he gives you an apple, and if you don't eat it, like, that resolves your,
and also
your psychological problems.
It just so happens that our main character, like, has an apple company.
Yeah, it's an apple juice factory or something, right?
Yeah.
But anyway, so he leaves the office and like abandons both his wife and his mistress and the psychiatrist and whatever sort of bizarre promise of resolution that was going to provide, and just like hops on a trolley in the rubble and just runs away, which actually sort of connects the movie back to Great Freedom in a way, because he's sort of set up with a variety of choices, And instead of actually having the willpower and the courage to make any kind of choice, he just like hits detonate and runs off, sort of away from having to make any choice.
I don't want to talk about Ludwig until we're actually there, but I do think that then you could point that as the commonality among all these films,
mm-hmm.
Of our
well, I don't think
male protagonist.
You didn't watch Monty, right, Eli?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, but
I didn't get to, no.
John, you watched that one, and I think that one also kind of fits description as well with regards to the male character in that film.
No, yeah, it definitely makes sense. I don't know if this is like a running theme to the movies. It just happens like it does feature a little bit of that. Mumpy is like a weird, strange movie. Yeah. It actually has a lot of common with this one, where so much of the film is driven by sheer not narrative, comic, and at some points, and also technical invention. Where less of a narrative throw line, it's more like here's the next crazy idea we came up with. Maybe less satisfying though than this movie,
yeah.
Which I feel like we all really. It's at least a very fun film to talk about.
Yeah, I mean it was super fun, and actually after talking about it again, I kind of want to see it again because there is so much happening in any given shot in it. That as we're talking about this stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of realized that was happening, but it didn't like register fully because we're so quickly on to the next thing, like the bit about the lion eating the lamb.
Well, unlike, you know, the, more, flowing, takes and the atmosphere qualities of Great Freedom, you know, this is, because there are so many gags, it is, you know, in a very different style, almost like a comic.
Mm. Well, I did read that this one emerged from an unproduced cabaret that he had developed with his cabaret troupe that he worked with in the 30s. Which I think goes a long way towards explaining, I think, what you're getting at there, which is that it does feel like a series of scenes. And as John was saying, that's something that I think crops up in Monty too. Like, it just sort of moves from one idea to the next in a way that would make a lot of sense in a sort of cabaret setting, but is maybe a little bit more unusual as a narrative structure for a movie like this. But
well, yeah, because it is... you know, explicitly shot on a soundstage, whereas, you know, you don't really get that feeling with Great Freedom, obviously.
Well, Great Freedom definitely feels like you can feel the set design.
Exactly.
But it's always, like, gesturing towards something that's real. Like, there's a patina of artificiality on it, but it's never, like, divorced from something like... the real world, which is actually why I think that film works the best for me among his films, because it finds that exact perfect balance between the sort of fantasy visions and the kind of the realism of like the place of
yeah I really like them both. They're yeah. just so different approaches.
Let's take one more break and then we'll be back to discuss Ludwig.
Was für ein Tag ist denn heute, Herr Professor? Der 13. Juni, Majestät. Der 13. Juni. Ich habe nämlich beschlossen, am heutigen Tag ein neues Leben zu beginnen. Freiheit. Große Freiheit.
Welcome back. And the last film we're going to be talking about today is Ludwig II.
Glanz und Ende eines Königs.
Yes, thank you. I was not ready to... pronounce the German subtitle, but which means something like the Mad King or something to that effect. But anyways, this was a film that Kautner made in the mid-50s. It came out in 1955. And some of the other films, that, as I had mentioned at the beginning, that I've seen from around this period with Kautner are of that sort of more dry, serious, maybe even approaching kind of neorealist war film. This is definitely not that. It harkens back to what he was doing maybe in the 40s, and the films we've discussed is sort of more lurid in terms of the color and the set design, but is still, I think, very much about the specific time and the sort of like ideological currents through which Ludwig lived. And so, Eli, after you had watched this film, I think you messaged me saying that you were surprised how much this film that was ostensibly centered on Ludwig actually focused on Wagner, which I had in my mind when I sat down to watch it. Because of that, I had sort of expected that the movie was actually going to treat Wagner as a really central character that we follow throughout.
Okay, I can see where the confusion would come there.
Okay, but hold on.
I stand by what I say,
And I'm going to get to that in a second, because I sort of was watching the movie and Wagner shows up, and I was thinking that, okay, so we're really going to watch their relationship, and there's some interesting stuff about their relationship that we can get into. But I think that what you were really getting at, which dawned on me after I finished the film, was that even though Wagner disappears from the narrative and isn't really a central character throughout, what does come through very clearly and what's very important to the film and its conception of Ludwig is how important Wagner's art and his sort of capital R romanticism is to Ludwig. The movie's vision of Ludwig's madness is basically centered around his obsession with Wagner's music and its insanity, as he says. And so I think that relationship is essential to understanding the film, which despite its subtitle of Ludwig as the Mad King, I don't think it really treats Ludwig as being all that crazy. I think he's mostly an aesthete who's in the role of a monarch and sort of ill-suited to this time of ratcheting up war and the games of politics. And I think the movie goes out of its way to show that sort of friction that he has as role in this role of a monarch and also being a fundamentally aesthetically inclined person. Like we get a few speeches where Ludwig's advisors are talking about the importance of war and how a German Reich can only emerge through conflict. And Ludwig's sort of response, and I think the fundamental vision of this film for him as a character, is that he says that he wants to build a kingdom of muses, and that his madness is really it's about the promises of romantic art in a time that in a place that doesn't really have interest in crafting a society around those ideals and is really focused on power and politics.
I think that is certainly part of it, and like half of it, let's say. But the other half of it would be his vicarious, let's say, PTSD from his, is it cousin, whoever Klaus Kinski plays, which is, yes, Klaus Kinski is in this movie, and he's not the crazy one in this movie. But what happens to him, and when Ludwig tries to confront the devastation of what war has done and the fact that Bavaria is now essentially at the heels of Bismarck, he retreats to continually building these castles that are almost an adolescent fantasy in the way that it is his way of processing his love of Wagner's music and hiding away from the world, and that is what drives him crazy. Because at the end of the movie, I think it is unquestionable that he has gone mad in the last half hour or so. But you're right that it is not, I think, meant to be in any sort of hereditary madness as much as the factors that I and you had touched upon. John, what do you think?
For me, a lot of this movie centers on, I guess, Ludwig as this essentially very lonely figure. And there's, I guess, it's a kind of a cliched idea of seeing like these monarchs as being reclusive and all those ideas. But Ludwig, had, from everything that we're told about this movie, I think the conception of the character is someone who has basically no interest in ruling, whatsoever. He holds, he assumes powers at a young age. He is impressed and deeply inspired by Wagner's music, and as you guys are talking about, that kind of that leads him to shrink away from whatever actual responsibilities and his role should be as a monarch. The movie presses up, like history basically presses upon him to make certain choices and to do certain things, but at every turn he kind of wants to turn away from that. Because I don't know if this is because of the what we were talking about regarding Kinski's character and that stuff. Just feel like I simply feel like so much of this movie is given over to the conception of a character who is has basically absolutely no interest in ruling, is a private romantic character who cares more about like those moments, I think, with who was it? I think you guys were talking, I think it was the cousin or something like that, who that love affair that never really happened, right? So much of that is given over to the frustration that he was never able to express himself in that way, and he takes out all his creative energies or whatever that drives him into funding Wagner's, you know, art, creating these castles, doing all this stuff that makes him kind of seem eccentric, but really he's just almost following his own muse. The one part of the movie that I feel exemplifies this character the most, I would say, is whenever he takes the... I guess it's another cousin of his or something like that.
Yeah, it's
like
not
that.
Sissy. It's like the one that he's... that they're like trying to set him up with.
Yes. Right. And they set up this... He sets up this kind of concert for them. And she expects this to be like her introduction into society as like next to Ludwig. But then there's just an empty hall.
Yes.
And it's such a strange moment. Mm-hmm. Basically saying this is like me, this is who I am, this is what I can give you, this is kind of like how I see myself in relation to society almost. It's very strange.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that sequence. I think that is in a lot of ways the central sequence in the film, and I think like you're saying, the strangeness of it comes from just the absolute disconnect of these two people sort of talking totally past each other, because her reaction is so like horrified that she's there, like something just deeply unsettles her about being sort of walked into this empty theater and sat in the king's box at the top and to have no one else there. And yet it's like someone from Ludwig's perspective, someone who's sharing the deepest emotional parts of himself, as you suggest, and the strangeness of the scene just comes from neither one of them having any ability to conceptualize what this moment means for the other.
Very well put, and I think that actually goes back to one of his conversations with Wagner earlier, and there are other things I do want to get into about Wagner, because when I said that this is a biopic of Wagner, I was of course being a bit facetious, because he does leave the movie 45 minutes in, but his music is terrifically used throughout the movie, and that's a really delicate thing to do, is to use, you know, these, you know, amazing masterworks for your own score. It is something that often goes very wrong in movies, but I think it works here. But yeah, Wagner, when trying to plead with Ludwig not to send him away, he says that these works are yours as much as they are mine, or something along those lines. And I think that goes
that Ludwig must have internalized that at some point when he invites this woman to his private box, that Ludwig sees this music, which he did not write, but he sees it as so close to him that it is an extension of himself. And it's, yeah, I totally agree. It's a very great scene. I really like, don't remember the character's name, but when, Sissy, rejects that other man, and they're out on the, mountains, after she leaves, it almost looks like a, Caspar David Friedrich painting, and, that ties into the whole general, romantic with a capital R qualities that you had alluded to earlier. I just wanted to bring that up before I forgot.
Yeah, just to circle back to what you were saying about, again, that sequence in the opera house. I like your suggestion that he basically sort of treats the Wagner's art as if it's his own art, because I think, as sort of what John was saying too, it's like there's a way in which the way he shares that moment with her is almost as if like someone sharing a piece of art that they themselves created, and like very sort of wanting to share that with a loved one. But like, I don't know if there's really that much indication that he actually like loves her. If anything, the relationship that sort of has the most erotic charge in the film is his relationship with Wagner, and that sequence that you alluded to where he comes and basically confronts Wagner and sends him away, he sort of comes to that sequence and the whole thing is shot as if he's like a jilted lover coming to confront someone that's cheated on him. And the way that sort of...
I think that, yeah.
That mirrors, I think it's... or sort of is the opposite of the way that he actually has this relationship with this woman who is ostensibly his lover is interesting.
You're exactly spot on. He doesn't really have much chemistry with the woman in this movie, I think, even though you do have this lovely scene with them at the lake by moonlight.
More fake clouds.
Yes, the great fake clouds. I love it. And that is not the fake clouds, but the scene by moonlight does, I believe, is accompanied by some music from Tristan and Isolde, and you know, just this connection of one love story to another. But you do get this sense that by comparing it to Tristan and Isolde, you see how this is not Ludwig's real love. His real love is music about this love story with Tristan und Isolde. And I don't quite agree that it is erotically charged with Wagner, but yes, definitely does seem like a very harsh end of a relationship that neither person wants to do. And it is one of the most interesting depictions of a benefactor and an artist that I've seen, really. Because it is, of course, a historically very interesting relationship, and I think Kautner did a very good job with that.
Yeah, well, the erotic charge, though, I think comes up, too, in the first sequence that he meets Wagner, less so in that sequence because it is sort of like the end of their relationship, but when Wagner first walks into the palace after Ludwig has, like, called him in, there's this, like, shot of Ludwig looking at Wagner that it looks like someone has just been struck by like the most beautiful person they've ever seen. Like he sort of has this almost lusty look at Wagner. And I think the movie doesn't really explore Ludwig's sexuality in any kind of open way in terms of the narrative of the film. But I do think there is something there in the way that it conceptualizes his fascination with not just Wagner's music, but also, like Wagner as a person, sort of as an emissary or a representation in the world of his art.
Yes, he does kiss Wagner on the cheek. So it is a very strange relationship. And right after that, Wagner is playing an early version of the Liebestod from Tristan und Isolde on the piano. And, Ludwig is shown from behind watching him, awestruck in a way that is really tender. Also, I just want to say, skipping a bit later, I did not at first realize that it was the same actor who was playing Ludwig II after he grew the facial hair and went completely insane. I thought it was a different person at first.
He has good facial hair.
His performance is so... Well, I mean, his performance is so different. You have this idealistic, romantic young king, and then the paranoid, closed off to the world, raving in, secluded guy with the beard who almost looks like the guy who played Ivan the Terrible in The Eisenstein.
It has just had that similar pointy beard vibe going on.
Yes.
So it happens when you grow beards. It's a dangerous game. Yeah, I just don't know that I feel his madness in those sequences all that much. I don't know. John, did you find him to... Did that register for you?
I didn't... For me, I never saw him as, truly being mad, in a sense. I don't ever feel like the movie's telling you, yes, he has gone mad at this point. People around him are right.
You don't think by the end he's... at least the very end, you must think he's mad, right?
Yeah, I mean, at the very end, obviously, I feel like... Yeah, he has reached a point to where it's not really deniable that, there's something, wrong with him. I don't know if, ever, truly, felt it from the kind of the actor playing it. It's more like I understand, oh, this is kind of, what they're going for. It's more conceptual for me. Mm-hmm. Not really, oh, yes, he's gone completely mad, and the actor is selling me completely on this.
Well, I disagree. I think he does a good job, and B, I think that we are supposed to take him as mad. I think Kautner really sells it, too, by dressing his actor in these long robes and making him look very, withered and sleep-deprived as he runs up stairs to a tower and is lit almost like a ghost in the cave areas of his castle. I don't think he's completely out of his wits, perhaps, and I think as I said earlier, this is not hereditary. This is through multiple factors, a matter of results of what happened when this person's idealism was crushed.
Right, it's a madness that's, to me, doesn't even feel like I was saying, madness all that much. It is someone who's withdrawn and angry at the failure of the realization of his ideology, but it's just interesting that, I mean, and obviously we just, I guess, feel differently about this, but to me, given Kautner's penchant for delirium, there's no reason that Kautner couldn't have just turned it up to 11 and made him just seem totally nutty, which he doesn't really do. I agree that the movie is sort of forced to communicate to us that he is mad because that is the story of Ludwig. But it's interesting that, at least from my vantage point, Kautner pulls back on that a little bit because there is something to be said about, Kautner's own kind of romanticism and tendency towards sort of Baroque expressionism that I can only assume he had some sort of identification with that ideological strain that Ludwig has of sort of creating a world that's based in that sort of extreme expression of style, and that he doesn't, at least for me, view Ludwig as all that insane. I think speaks to maybe the affinity that he feels with Ludwig, and that it's really the societal pressures that determine Ludwig's madness, as it were, and nothing so much that's internal to the way that his mind works. He just has an ideology that's unacceptable to the society that he lives in, and it drives him away.
You know, that there's a moment near the end when he's on the castle, at the castle where he's essentially trapped at with the doctor. They're taking a walk, and he's muttering to himself something about freedom, great freedom.
Yes, oh yeah.
Well, that ties everything together, is what I'm saying.
All of a piece. You're right, I did notice that.
Obviously just a coincidence. And I think it's curious that he meets with Bismarck and Franz Joseph in the first half, before war breaks out, and just like Wagner, although I think they might show up very briefly near the end, they sort of disappear from the movie halfway through, and... I think the fact that all these people just disappear from this movie shows his growing isolation in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fascinating film that I think is, you know, white elephant art, as we would say. And it's this very opulent biopic, but it does have this weird... energy that is very uniquely Kautner throughout.
Yeah, and I think that it doesn't get trapped by a lot of the biopic sort of banalities, because it has this sort of dialectic at the center of it, of this sort of romantic ideology and that sort of encountering the real world of politics that... the movie has a almost even like Hegelian kind of back and forth that is sort of bubbles underneath the narrative structure that is maybe more conventionally like a biopic about this person. But there's something more like interesting happening under the surface in that regard for me anyways, which I think is what maybe draws Kautner to be interested in this film that would otherwise appear maybe a little bit more, straight-jacketed.
Hey, Evan, don't you mean encountering the world of politics?
Indeed. Indeed.
One more thing, and I'm not sure how much we talked about the zooms and reverse zooms that happen in these movies sometimes, but they're really effective, and I like once, after Kinski faints, it dissolves into these weird dark glasses. And it turns out to be the first appearance of, you know, Dr. Gooden, who doesn't make it to the end of the movie. weird, good stuff.
Yeah, and also, just in terms of the little, like, visual touches, Kautner, I think, it does seem like he really loves mirrors, and this one is really filled with all kinds of mirrors. I think there's a sequence where they are supposed to be at Versailles, which has the famous like, Hall of Mirrors. And I think in that sequence, it's actually like a painted backdrop because they didn't go to Versailles. But the other castles where they actually shot in, the sort of ornate mirrors and finery definitely comes through as a sort of essential part of the film's visual texture.
Yeah, that weird mad glint.
Mm-hmm.
So any last thoughts?
Did you want to mention the Ludwig manga, John? Now's your shot.
Oh, no, that's more like, that's more just a little
that's
joke.
That's off the record, banter.
No, I'll say it then. There's a Ludwig II yaoi manga that John brought to our attention, so thank you very much.
It looks pretty fun.
And this movie, on a personal note, has also inspired me to listen to more Wagner again, which is really nice.
you know, as someone who had very little historical knowledge of both of these figures, like, I knew, obviously I know who they are, but I did not really know anything regarding their relation. This movie, as like a historical subject, I didn't really care about it whatsoever. As this kind of, it solidified for me a little bit of my conception of Kautner as a director, someone who's, I think, technical, for me, by this point even mastery, got me through some of the passages in some of his films that I found less interesting. For example, like in Romance in a Minor Key earlier in his career, I thought maybe the story was never that interesting to me, but basically Kautner's direction always kept me engaged. In this film, and perhaps I did not, the enthusiasm never came across to me for Ludwig, because I find it just a really hard film to talk about.
I can see that, yeah.
in this particular, in Ludwig, the historical conception, or how it works as a biography, as a biopic, I don't really care about that much.
Yeah.
What mattered to me was the almost how Kautner captures this performance of Ludwig as someone who's kind of retreated from the world and solely exists in these private moments. You guys were talking about earlier when he was watching Wagner play the piano or something like that, and in that moment you get a glimpse into this private world where all his ideas regarding the nature of what a ruler should be, of what his country should be, right, of how he wants people to be like, you know, muses and, you know, artists and all that nature and all that stuff. He doesn't want anything to do with like war. In those moments where you see that, we catch that glimpse of that private self, that's where this movie kind of works the best for me, especially at the end. In those little gestures, the laying down of the rose at his grave, that's the shot you guys were talking about regarding where they go to Versailles. It's just a little bit kind of almost spooky nature to it, where it's hard to explain what logical meaning there is behind such an image or such a camera movement, but it still transports you to another like emotional state where it's easy to understand why Ludwig would take his, you know, date to the empty opera hall. I find this to be maybe the second or third best of the films I saw here for Kautner. It's just very strange, beguiling movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, Wagner in real life was a huge piece of shit, so it's maybe good you didn't have that much historical context.
I think I knew that much about Wagner.
That's pretty standard, I would say. But
all right, well, closing thoughts on Kautner. Let me just say that John mentioned Romance in a Minor Key, and I really, really like that movie. If one is a fan of Ophuls in his style, I think it's the of the Kautner films that I've seen, it's one that, more than any other, really brings to mind Ophuls. That'd be my main recommendation of the ones we didn't talk about today.
Yeah, Monty was the one that I was like the most irritated while watching it. But a part of me kind of wishes we had talked about it, because I do think it is really fascinating, and it doesn't have the same kind of feeling as Ophuls, but the camera movements in that one are worthy of Ophuls. Like the way he moves these sort of like long tracking shots through the streets of Paris and then through these sets is really striking, though the sort of narrative mechanics that are happening in that film are, like, I can't decide if they're, like, actively offensive or just totally incoherent, but the movie itself is fascinating. And it does have a great introduction by Kautner, who basically goes, is in the intro of the film, does this sort of voiceover and describes why they're not going to speak in French in this film that's set in Paris, because German audiences don't want to read subtitles, and then they just, like, switch to speaking in German the whole time, which I really like.
The movie kind of won me over after that. Although, yes, the conception of the characters and their behavior is kind of all over the place.
Yeah. But yeah, that opening is great.
Well, auf Wiedersehen, mein Freundin.
Thank you guys for having me on this episode.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Thanks for joining us.
Yes,
that's
thank
great.
You very much. And we hope to have you again sometime, because this was really good.
Next time, we gotta talk about One Piece.
Don't worry, I'm gonna make Evan read all of it.
The all manga episode.
Yes.
Okay, I'll have to block out significant chunks of time for that one. But okay, thanks everyone, and we'll be back next time.